Welcome back, Question Medicine. 2019 is Danger Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Oh, it has been a while. There has been so many things going on, and let me tell you, I have been busier than the Pope on Ash Wednesday. The Better Brain has been sick. I have been helping around the house more than normal, which is, I mean, realistically, not that much. She does everything. I just get to come home and do some podcasts. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. 2019, Question Medicine. It is good to be back. Angel Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And before we get started, I should clarify, she doesn't do anything. We split a lot of the chores. I do things at home. I can just see me already getting emails being like, that's the most sexist thing you've ever said. You can't say that. You know, women need to do half the work and men do. I get it. Yes, I get it. I get it. I get it. It was just a joke, people. It was a joke. So without further ado, let's get into the first article. All right. Recently on Question Medicine, I mentioned how if you are starting dialysis, then you need to have an end of life conversation because your odds of dying after 5 years are greater than 50%. It doesn't matter how good your health you think you're in. It doesn't matter if you think you're going to die. The odds are you're going to die, and you're going to die a lot sooner if you're on dialysis. Well, it turns out not all countries have the same organ donor rates as the United States. I recently learned in this article titled Disparities in Acceptance of Decreased Donor Kidneys Between the United States and France and Estimated Effects of Increased U.S. Acceptance from JAMA Internal Medicine that in the United States, we are picky. We are actually really picky about the kidneys that we pick. And in other countries, they're not as picky. They have this approach called old for old. It basically means that the kidneys they take are not as pristine. The kidneys that they take are from older individuals. They still work just fine, but instead of maybe having a perfect GFR, it's maybe only a GFR of, I don't know, 45, 50, 60, because they're older kidneys. But if you have a new kidney, you get off dialysis. If you get off dialysis, you gain life years, which is important. So let's dig into this study just a little bit. You see, 50% of donors in Spain are older than 60 years old, and more than 30% are older than 70. That does not happen here in America. Currently, in the United States, we throw away about 18% of our kidneys, but if we apply the same rules, this old for old, as the French do, we could go from 18% down to 7%. Now, those are just percentages, so let's look at the real numbers so you can get a real sense of how big of a deal this really is. You see, we throw away almost 28,000 kidneys, but if we use the French model, we would only throw away about 10,000 kidneys, which means almost 18,000 extra transplants, which means, again, more lives saved. The mean age of kidneys transplanted in the United States is about 36 years old compared to 50 years old in France. Yes, the kidneys are not as perfect. In fact, they have been aged just like humans and the skin and our heart and our livers and everything else that exists. When you have an extra 17 years or 15, 16 years of age on an organ, it does do a little bit of damage. They're not as perfect, pristine kidneys, but they are kidneys. And in this study, they concluded that if we changed our rules, we just changed them to fit how the French do theirs, how Europe does their kidney transplants, then we would generate an additional 132,000 life years in the United States over a 10-year observation period. That is a lot of years. Per year, that means we're looking at roughly 13,000 lives saved per year. Big deal, big time. I think we might as well change it. I mean, I can tell you, if I have chronic kidney disease, if I am renting a chair 3 days a week, either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, if I'm in this position, I don't care if the GFR is only 45. I don't care if the GFR is only 30 for that matter. I'm sitting at zero. Anything better than zero is good with me. And I can promise you, if you put it in me, I would stop smoking. I would stop drinking. I would treat that thing like a treasure because that's what it is, a treasure, a golden ticket for extra years of life. And speaking of the golden ticket, speaking of the golden treasure chest of life, how about this paper titled Experience with HPV Self-Sampling and Clinician-Based Sampling in Women Attending Routine Cervical Screening in the Netherlands? I have said it before on Question Medicine. I'll say it again on Question Medicine, and I'll probably be saying it until the end of time. If you are not doing the self-swab for cervical cancer screening, then you are doing a disservice to your patients. This study was based on two assumptions. First of all, we know that when it comes to STD testing, the patient is clearly better than the physician at doing the self-swab and coming up with gonorrhea and chlamydia. We have already proven this in studies. And this has also been shown with HPV, except for the confidence intervals overlap. So you can't clearly say that self-swab is better for HPV testing, but you can say it shows a trend to significant improvement. And I can tell you that if you have enough studies that create a trend, then you could have a big, analysis that would then say, ooh, this trend seems to have enough signal that we should start doing just self-swabs. What do you know? But let's dig into the details of this study, the IMPROVE study, with near 5,600 women randomized in a one-to-one ratio to self or clinician-collected HPV testing, and the HPV-positive women were retested using the other collection method. It should come no surprise to anyone that when they asked the women that were HPV positive, that had both the clinician and the self-swab, they said, what is your preference? Which one do you prefer? The women reported significantly lower levels of shame, nervousness, discomfort, and pain during the self-swab than they did during the clinician-based sampling. And I don't care who you are or how good you think your sampling or swabbing is, you're not going to be good as good as the woman doing it herself in the room by herself in the privacy of what could be as much privacy as you can get of just a outpatient clinic room. Now, you might be saying to yourself, oh, of course they liked it, but how much more could they really like it? Well, of the women that were HPV positive, about 80% of those individuals preferred the self-sampling. Of the HPV negative women, 89% indicated that they prefer self-sampling to the clinician-based sampling when they had future screenings. Because remember, they only were opted, you know, into one or the other. But they said, in the future, can I get that self one? That one would be for me. Here's what we know. Self-swabbing is at least no worse. And it is, in fact, probably better. We know for sure it's better when it comes to testing for STDs. We know that our patients prefer it over the clinician testing, or at least roughly 8 or 9 out of 10 prefer it. So when we have a test that is probably better, or at least a trend towards better, and we have a test that is preferred, that should be the one we use, unless our patient falls into the small category, the 1 in 10 or 1.5 in 10, that actually prefers the clinician test. But you'll never know if you don't offer it to your patient. On to the next article. Now, this next article has been talked about and talked about and talked about some more, and I think everyone has actually talked about it except for me right here on Question Medicine. So without further ado, let me jump in to the CREDENCE trial. That is right, the CREDENCE trial. Canagliflozin and renal outcomes in type 2 diabetes and nephropathy. This study is a big deal. In fact, it's such a big deal, I would say it's in one of the top 10 articles of 2019. It hit newsstands everywhere. People went crazy. They were tweeting about it. They were talking about it. You've probably already heard about it, but in case you have not, let me try to break it down. Basically, type 2 diabetics with a lot of protein in the urine, chronic kidney disease. They had type 2 diabetes for about 15 years. The albumin to creatinine ratio was greater than 900. These are individuals that we see all the time. And they picked an outcome or a primary outcome that was super interesting and super fascinating, and it was a renal outcome. It was a composite of end-stage renal disease or doubling of the serum creatinine level from baseline or death from renal or cardiovascular disease. This is a big deal because, as we have discussed on almost every study in Questioning Medicine and really every study ever, you usually don't pick an outcome that has to do with kidney function, because if you do, you do microalbuminuria, you do the frothy urine, because it's easy for that outcome to exist, or it's easy to find a difference in that outcome. You almost never make your outcome Well, how often do they go dialysis? Because it's such an exceedingly rare event, and it takes so long to happen. Rarely do people go from a GFR of, I don't know, 45 down to needing dialysis overnight. That takes 10, 12, 13 years usually. I mean, it takes a long time. So you don't start that type of trial because it's going to take too long. You're not going to be able to get your drug to market. You're not going to be able to get that FDA-approved indication. But that's what they did in this randomized placebo-controlled trial. They used 100 milligrams of canagliflozin versus placebo, and then they followed them up for 2.6 years. Now, before we get into the results, I got to let you know that this study, this CREDENCE trial, showed that canagliflozin only decreased the hemoglobin A1C by 0.25%. Yep, that's right, 0.25%. So if your A1C was 7.5, it's now 7.25. And if the blood pressure was, I don't know, 130, well, in the end, it only decreased it by about 2-3 millimeters of mercury systolic. This drug that actually did show benefit, it may not actually be a diabetes medication. It might just be a person medication. Let's get back to this trial. As I said, the results here were basically cardiovascular or renal death, doubling of your creatinine, or needing to go on dialysis. The number needed to treat in this primary composite outcome was 22. That's pretty impressive. And when you looked at it and you broke it down, it really didn't necessarily matter whether you were talking about cardiovascular death, whether you're talking about going on dialysis, doubling of creatinine. This drug actually seemed to do it all. And as we talked about earlier, maybe it was the prevention of death because those individuals then went on dialysis. I'm not really sure. Either way, here's what I know. The drug works. There was a reduction, the hazard ratio reduction around 0.7 for renal outcomes. When you looked at losartan in the renal R-E-N-E-A-A-L trial back in 2001, New England Journal of Medicine, hazard ratio for reduction in renal events was around 0.8. This was around 0.7, and it was on top of individuals who already had to be on losartan just to get in the trial. But I think that just goes to show how good of a drug this really is. I'm sure there will become a negative to this drug. I'm sure we're going to find some sort of side effect in the future. I completely believe it, but these drugs seem to do something. It's separate of glucose. It's separate of blood pressure. They do something that we can't necessarily explain, and in the end, they work. I'm not saying that these drugs work better than metformin, but in high-risk individuals, these SGLT2 inhibitors seem to have a hard case for at least second-line therapy. Yes, we should do diet and exercise. Yes, metformin is probably first-line in those that are mildly uncontrolled. But in those individuals that have higher risk, those individuals who have heart failure, and those individuals who are getting close to getting on dialysis, have renal dysfunction, chronic kidney disease, these drugs are making a strong argument to become first line. I still think we're with metformin for sure, no doubt, but these drugs, these SGLT2 inhibitors, are certainly making a case to show benefit and possibly move to the forefront of diabetic control. But again, the interesting thing is they don't do that good in diabetic or A1C control, which begs the question, are they people drugs, or are we looking at the wrong surrogate marker when it comes to diabetes? I will leave that one up to you. There are always a lot of changes in medicine. Some changes for the good, some changes for the bad, and some changes are better for board tests. This next paper, or this next recommendation from the United States Preventive Services Task Force, is better for the board exam. You see, previously, we tested everyone for HIV, but when it came to Hep C, well, we were only supposed to test the baby boomer population. That's right, those individuals between 1945 and 1965. If you were born during that time frame, well, then you were supposed to get tested for Hep C, according to the 2013 statement. But then, out just recently, the USPSTF said, well, you see, there's really not much of a difference here in 1944 and 1945. There's not much of a difference in 1966 and when the recommendation actually was 1965. So maybe, just maybe, we should test everyone. Which isn't a bad recommendation in and of itself, because Hep C is estimated to have a prevalence around 1%. That is right, 1%. If you know 100 people, then one of those people probably, likely, just based on statistics, has Hep C. If you have a patient population of, I don't know, 900 patients, 9 of your patients should have Hep C. And if you don't have 9 patients with Hep C, well, then maybe it's because you haven't been testing. Luckily for you, the new recommendations, the new guidelines gives a grade B recommendation, which says high certainty of net benefit is moderate for those individuals, and those individuals being everyone, if they have a pulse, if they are breathing, everyone should be tested for Hep C. That's the new recommendation, and luckily that is now the new board answer. Everyone gets tested for Hep C. I learned my alphabet relatively early in life, and I know that the letter right after C is D, which leads me to vitamin D. I know all the time, I say to myself, this is going to be the last time I talk about vitamin D. And then a new study comes out and I have to talk about it. And I, of course, am talking about this study published in JAMA titled The Effect of High-Dose Vitamin D Supplementation on Volumetric Bone Density and Bone Strength. Again, I think this is a huge, super important study because as much as I say, listen, vitamin D doesn't really matter, it doesn't show what we thought it does. Sure, we know that having a high one is good and a low one is bad, but treating low vitamin D with medications doesn't seem to help. It doesn't matter if we fix your low vitamin D and make it high, it doesn't seem to benefit. Well, in this study, they said, let's give vitamin D. Let's give high doses of vitamin D and low doses of vitamin D. You see, they took 311 adults, randomized them into three different categories. You either got 10,000 international units of vitamin D per day, you got 4,000 international units of vitamin D per day, or you got 400 international units of vitamin D per day. I will say that at 400 units, almost no one, even those individuals who believe in vitamin D, would argue that 400 international units of vitamin D is not enough to do anything. It's not enough to lick the salt off the back of your hand, if you know what I'm saying. So they then followed these individuals up and they did a high sensitivity CT to measure the total volume of the bone in the distal radius and the tibia. They did a high sensitivity CT. Why did they do the high sensitivity CT, you ask? Well, I am glad that you asked because I asked the same question. I said, why would we not use a DEXA scan? That doesn't make any sense to me. Of course, we should definitely use a DEXA scan because that's what we use in real life to tell about osteoporosis. Well, it turns out that this high resolution quantitative CT scan is actually better. It is better than a DEXA scan. It is like this. If you are going to wherever you're going and it's 20 miles away, I could tell you, you should go 5 miles and turn right, go 6 miles and turn left, or I could be much more precise, like a high resolution quantitative CT scan. I should say, you go 9,421 feet and then turn left. You go 6,455 feet, then turn right. You see, it is much more sensitive to pick up just small, minute little changes. And so what did it find? What did this high sensitivity better test find at the end of 3 years, you ask? Or I asked, well, those individuals that randomized to the higher international units of vitamin D actually had more bone loss, less bone strength than those individuals in the 4,000 and than those individuals in the 400. In fact, the 400 group lost the least, the 4,000 group lost the middle amount, and the 10,000 group, the high dose group, lost the most. Vitamin D probably doesn't do what we think it does. In fact, it's probably not beneficial at all. And in high doses or in certain doses, even 4,000 international units, which is not crazy by any standards, it might be harmful. I think that is an end. That is a stop. That is where we'll end, and we will end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. So without further ado, let's wrap up the articles I talked about in 30 seconds or less. Here we go. If you are on a transplant list for a kidney in the United States, well, then maybe you should move to France because they take older kidneys, not nearly as perfect, but with the transplants, with the newer kidneys that aren't nearly as perfect, we are gaining lives. We need to adopt that here in America. Look for it. Hopefully that's in the future. It is being talked about, and I just found this article incredibly fascinating in JAMA Internal Medicine. If you ever do HPV testing or cervical cancer testing, you should be offering self swabs. Bottom line, end of discussion. We're not going to go in the evidence here. I've talked about it ad nauseum. I've written about it ad nauseum. I don't know why it's not being done everywhere, because it is just as good and women prefer it. The SGLT2 inhibitors, canagliflozin, empagliflozin, dapagliflozin, they are here, they are real, and they're here to stay. Canagliflozin, diabetic renal outcomes with those patients with diabetes, it improved renal outcomes. Such a hard endpoint, such an impossible endpoint to usually get to in most studies, and this study went ahead and did it. But the net change was 0.25 in the A1C, 0.25 at roughly 2.5 years. This may not be a diabetes drug. We might find out in the near future that this is a person drug. It's for everyone, not necessarily just diabetics. There is good news if you take a board exam anytime in the near future, or if you just happen to be reading United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendations and you can't remember them all. Well, now Hep C and HIV, everyone, yes, everyone is recommended to be screened. If they have breathing, if they have a pulse, they should be screened. When should they be screened, you ask? It doesn't specifically say. I would recommend doing it if you do yearly or baseline labs, or maybe the first time the patient comes to you, they're establishing care. Just go ahead and throw it in. We should test everyone. It's 1% of the population. Look at your patient panel, and if you don't have at least 1% of your patient panel, it's because you're missing it. Not because it's not there. And last but not least, of course, vitamin D. It is so good. It's so good. It will actually help you lose bone function strength. Oh, ouch. And with that, let's end this podcast, and I will say adieu. We'll end this one like we've ended everyone before it. Until next time, keep quest and questioning.